Methodology Minutes is brought to you by the Methodology Center at Penn State.
Hello and welcome to Methodology Minutes. With me today is John Ziyech, Research Associate at the Methodology Center. John is also the lead software developer currently on our LCA project, and he's an LCA researcher. John, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much. Hello, everybody.
So, John, just to kind of kick this off, can you tell us what LCA is for?
I think that Bethany Bray and Stephanie Lanza already said this, but it's a latent variable technique that tries to summarize the responses of categorical items by dividing people into latent categories. Mathematically, what's going on is that you're trying to find a simple model that summarizes the patterns of relationships between categorical items. In practice, what it often means is that you're trying to find a story about how different groups of people respond differently in systematic ways to the items.
Can you give us an example of why someone would want to use LCA?
I think people are looking for empirical subgroups of symptoms or behaviors. Sometimes this is done very self-consciously to try to come up with a typology for diagnosis. But I've seen articles where people have eating disorder symptoms or psychological symptoms and say, well, how many kinds of this are there according to the data, not according to just my judgment or the way it seems to me?
Right.
And I think that can be very useful. One caveat is that you're certainly measuring phenotypes, not genotypes. There's no guarantee that you're discovering something new in a hidden way about nature or about how the classes came about. It might be that you're just finding the most convenient ways to divide people's probabilities of responses on these items into broad groupings of people. But that's okay too.
Thanks, John. Could you give us some insight into how LCA works?
You need a model to do anything. And the LCA mathematical model is based on the idea of local independence. That it's not assuming that the items are all independent from each other, that whether you drink is independent of whether you got drunk. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But it's assuming that within any given class, your responses to items are, any relationship between them is already accounted for if you knew that the person was in that class. So if you knew that the person was a drinker, then the only way they would say that they didn't drink was by random chance. Or if you knew that the person had depression, which particular depression symptoms they mentioned, there was no further relationship with them. There weren't any subtypes of depression that you didn't find. Probably that local independence never really holds, but that's like everything else in statistics, really. If you have a large enough sample and look hard enough, say, think of a multiple regression setting. If your sample size is large enough, you can get anything to be significantly related to anything, even if the effect size is tiny. If it's true, this is paraphrased from a famous statistician, Box, who said, all models are wrong, but some models are useful. Even if it's true that you might need 15 classes to totally account for every relationship seen in your data, maybe 3 classes will still tell you everything you really need to know and can interpret.
So going back to that quote from Box, how do people know when they've got the quote-unquote right model?
Well, it's hard because I'm not trying to advocate total relativism.
Absolutely.
I'm not trying to say, mm-hmm, well, whatever model makes you happy, that's the correct model. That isn't science.
Right.
And even if I said that, it wouldn't matter because fortunately or unfortunately, we have peer reviewers and other people who are here to keep us accountable.
Gatekeepers.
And they're going to say, well, why did you pick 3 classes? Why didn't you pick 5? what criteria or tests did you use? And it's true that the criteria and tests are available, but they sometimes disagree, and the indications they give you might or might not be useful in your setting. I was talking just before about some people call it being overpowered in statistics. If your sample size is very large, then any reasonable model, you will be able to find something wrong with it.
You can identify a model if you've got a billion people in it.
Well, more like even if the five-class model already tells you everything that you can interpret. Like, for instance, suppose that in your topic, there aren't really five latent classes. There's a continuum of low to high, or maybe two dimensions. So depending on your sample size, the Fitts criteria might say, well, you should say there's low, medium, high. Or if your sample size is bigger, they might say you should say low, medium, high, high, and so on.
And so on, yeah.
Some people would say, well, in that situation, latent class analysis isn't appropriate because you should find some way of modeling the latent variable more realistically. I really am not convinced by that argument because I think that it's really hard to know what is the true shape of the distribution of a latent variable. And it may be kind of philosophically naive to say, if I just make my model fancy enough, I will find the true and real number of classes in the universe for my question.
Right. The reality is messy, and you may not be able to map your model onto it in a perfect way no matter what you do.
Yeah, that reminds me of a joke I read in Reader's Digest like 20 years ago, where the comedian was saying, I have a map on a one-to-one scale. I live in square C2. Either we need to do more research on scaled fit indices and relative fit, or maybe we just need to tell people, as Linda Collins and Stephanie Lanza do tell them in their book, I think, sometimes you have to use your judgment in addition to the bootstrap test and the AIC and the BIC.
Okay. All of that, I think, is a really excellent prelude to kind of the big question of this podcast, which is, if I've done an LCA, how do I know whether or not it worked?
Well, nobody can tell you whether you asked the right question.
Right.
So that's why you don't need to know what the right answer is, but you have to have some story before you start as to why you picked those items. It isn't completely garbage in, garbage out, but most of our users know that, I think. If you're a very beginner, it's tempting to say, cool, I'll just shovel my whole data set into this algorithm and it will come out with insights for me. Sometimes simple is good.
So how do we know if the LCA worked, though? What are we looking for?
Well, we have measures of relative fit. If you could see, do I need more classes? You could compare different numbers of classes informally using the Akieke information criterion or the Bayesian information criterion. Those weren't developed for mixture modeling, and they're not guaranteed to be always right, but they're a rule of thumb that people seem to respect, and it's better than nothing. You can also use the bootstrap likelihood ratio test to compare, do I need to add one more class in order to have adequate fit? Again, adequate is in the sense of statistical significance, not practical significance. It's okay to use your judgment if you don't think that an extra class is giving you anything you can actually interpret.
Meaningful information.
Sometimes, actually, it's really important to put your foot down because we encourage people to use multiple starting values and look at what we call identifiability. It's not quite the same thing as identifiability in the statistical sense, which basically means you have positive degrees of freedom and a model that makes sense. It's what we call identifiability is, we're not asking have you found the right answer for the population. We are asking, have you even found the right answer for your sample?
So the explanation that you'd given me for this at another time that really stuck in my head, I'm going to see if I can reflect it back to you and let me know if I'm off base here. you kind of encouraged me to imagine the class structure as a three-dimensional landscape, like a hilly mm-hmm. area, and the algorithm picking a random start, it puts somebody somewhere on the map. So you're on somewhere in a valley or somewhere, mm-hmm. and then your little person imaginarily on the map goes straight to the top of the nearest hill, but it's foggy up there, and they can't tell whether this is the highest hill or just the hill they happen to start up. So they know they're on the top of something, but they can't tell whether it's a local maximum, just a short hill that they happen to be near, or the global maximum, the highest point in the entire mountain range.
That's exactly how it works.
And so by starting, if you drop people 100 times on the map and they keep getting to the same high point, mm-hmm. odds are that's...
Or even if half of them get to the same high point,
right.
and there's 100 of them, mm-hmm. odds are that it's the highest.
Yeah.
You can never prove that there might not be a flagpole somewhere that's almost impossible to find but higher than everything else. But now you have to go back to common sense, and if your situation is that bizarre and contorted, well, maybe there's a class for unicorns, but maybe it's okay if you don't find it.
Yes, right. Exactly. Exactly.
So, yes, that's a good way to put it. So, we certainly encourage everybody to use instarts unless you have starting values that you've chosen and you really believe in. And personally, I think you should use instarts anyway, because just because you believe something doesn't mean it's true.
Yeah. You think you're putting the person at the base of the highest mountain on the map, but
if you really knew that,
why are you doing late class analysis?
Yeah. Why do you need to explore it all?
Yeah.
However, that's not what we said 10 years ago, and that's not what some smart people would still say today. They would say, this is supposed to be about theory, so you should use your theory at every stage. So when I said, so you should definitely use either instarts or a theoretically driven starting value data set. You should never just say start 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and go. Which one of those two good options is the best is, like a lot of other things, a judgment call. We like to see what we call percent identified. Again, there's no cutoff.
Yeah, no heuristic you can really follow.
We don't really say it has to be 20% or it has to be 50%, but if it's like 5%, it's somewhat worrisome. And so if AIC or BIC is telling you to have an 8-class model, but your answers for the 8-class model are so unstable that they're practically random, you pretty much have a responsibility to use a smaller number of classes because you don't want to be publishing random results.
So it sounds like you're saying the way to know if it worked is to look at your fit statistics, look at your relative identifiability, and to understand your theory and kind of apply it to the information that you're getting out of the model.
Yeah, I'm certainly not saying that you got the right answer if it was the answer you expected. That's not science.
Right.
But
no.
If it's something you can't explain at all, then it probably won't do you or your readers any good, and it will quite possibly lead people astray because they'll start coming up with fanciful stories for why is it that way.
How do I pick my items for my model?
At least our implementation of LCA seems to work best when you have a fairly moderate amount of items, like maybe 10 or less, each with a small number of categories, probably 2 would be the best number, and you know what each item means. What we call PROC-LCA is not really intended for mining large data sets with hundreds of variables. First of all, our software won't converge with that. And second, it's not what our software was designed for. Items kind of get an equal vote once you let them in the model. As it is with factor analysis also, if you have 10 items on alcoholism and 2 items on smoking, the class structure that's found will have more to do with alcohol than about smoking. And that's not a discovery. It's a consequence of the way you constructed your model. Covariates sometimes change the meaning of your classes. Items always do. And so when you're choosing measurement items, I guess this is just common sense, but they should all have to do with the story you're trying to tell or the question you're trying to investigate.
Yeah.
That's more important than just putting in a lot of data and hoping something good comes out.
Let's talk now about selecting the model.
Just like anything else in statistics, you want the model to be rich enough to tell you most of what's going on in your data set, but not so rich that it includes a lot of noise. So how do you tell whether you have enough classes, but not too much? One way is to use AIC and BIC. Another way is to use the bootstrap likelihood ratio test. Bethany Bray and Stephanie Lanza discussed both of these in podcast 15. As we mentioned before, another important thing to consider is the identifiability, because your fit statistics, it's pretty common that your fit statistic, if you have a large sample, your fit statistics would say, well, you know, I could make the fit even better if you let me have 10 classes instead of 9, or 11 instead of 10. But then when you check the percent identifiability, it's very poor. So we don't have a rule for you to follow, like in high school math, that will automatically get you the right answer. But you have to balance these two things in your mind somehow. And probably the tiebreaker will be the interpretability of the solution. So you'll print out the estimates from each of the model sizes you're considering and try to find out whether they tell you a story that makes sense. And there might not be a right answer. There might be several useful answers depending on what question you're asking.
There is a trade-off.
Yeah. And in any kind of practically any kind of statistical model, there's something called a bias-variance trade-off. If you pick a simple model, then it will be somewhat biased, not in the sense of it has an axe to grind, but in the sense of there are some features it's just going to miss because it wasn't looking for them. However, if you pick a complicated model, you even though you're increasing your potential to tell the right story, you're also much increasing your risk of telling a totally wrong story because of sampling error or random variability, or you just misunderstood the answer. Somewhere in between is a happy medium. Finding it is not really... There are tools to try to help you find it, like AIC and BIC, but they all have their own assumptions, and none of them are infallible. So finding it is kind of the main thing that makes these analyses an art and not just a science.
Can you tell us what percent identifiability we should look for when selecting a model?
First of all, if you use a really low number of random starts, then I can't give you any heuristic, because if you use, let's say, 3, they might all agree by chance. So let's say you use 100. I think if you're just exploring and checking out different model sizes, you're probably going to use like 20. But let's say you use 100. I think that if you're using 100, to me, I would feel okay if at least 25% of them got to the best. I wouldn't necessarily say it was wrong if less than 25% got you to the best obtained answer. But if 25 times they were able to find it, and all the other times were something poorer, it seems like they're probably not something that much better to be easily found. So that would seem reasonable to me.
So when should we bump up? When should a user bump up the number of end starts they're using?
I would like them to always use at least 20.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you would increase it if the percent agreement was kind of low, and so you wanted to see if maybe if I dropped more people onto that landscape, maybe some of them would find a taller mountain. If it's just not working and you're trying to increase in starts so that you can get some kind of an answer eventually, that's probably not as good.
Right. So questionable percentage of seat agreement would be a reason that you would encourage people
it's
to bump it
like
up.
That it's that you don't feel it is awful, but you don't feel it is great.
So let's say I'm using Proc LCA and my model won't converge. What causes that and what should I do about it?
Sometimes that can be fixed by adding a small prior, by adding a prior on beta or rho. Sometimes you don't converge because one of the covariates has an odds ratio that's extremely high and it can't find a finite estimate for it. I guess a classic example would be one of the classes is pregnant and one of the covariants is biological sex. So the males just can't get pregnant no matter, like with any probability, and so their odds ratio would be infinity. If any of the estimates come out as infinity, the proc will tell you it didn't converge, because converging means converging to something finite. So in that case, either you would look at your items and use common sense, or I guess you could use a prior. The prior is usually able to keep all the estimates finite. Keep it small, like prior size of 1 or 0.1. Another reason that your model might not converge is that you might just be asking for more than the data can give you. If you have, let's say you have 8 3-level items, that means that the contingency table that you're trying to describe is a table with 3^8 different cells, and you're trying to find a model to predict the proportions in each of those cells. And some of those cells are going to have really, really small proportions. It's going to be really hard to even approximate them all. And the word converged means that the algorithm was able to find one set of estimates that gives you a better log likelihood than any of the others that are in the neighborhood. If the model is so rich and the data is so poor that there are many ways to represent the data about equivalently, then either it won't converge or it will converge just to a local maximum. Because there is no global maximum, or the global maximum is found in many places. So if your model, my favorite thing to tell people, and I don't think it's their favorite thing to hear, is that if your model doesn't converge, use fewer covariates or fewer classes. That sounds like throwing out information, and maybe it sounds unscientific, and maybe, well, the AIC told me to use 8 classes. But again, having a stable and interpretable answer is just as important as having an extremely thorough answer. So another way to help models converge is to use the restrict option. But I don't encourage people to use it unless they have a really good a priori reason and know what they're doing. Because like a classic example for the restrict option would be the binge drinking class has zero probability of not using alcohol at all. Because if you're a total abstainer, then there's no way of binge drinking. But if you're just putting in restrictions to see which ones will get you to converge, that's not what restrict is designed for, because then you're putting in a posteriori restrictions as though they were part of the definition of your model. So you're putting them in as a priori, even though they're really exploratory. So partly because restrict is hard to use and easy to make a mistake with, but partly because most of the time I think we don't have a definite enough idea of what restrictions we want in order to make it scientifically reasonable to use restrict. I usually like to try to get people to simplify their model first. It sounds like a mean thing to do because, well, I could learn so much more if I had a richer model. But if you make your model too rich for you to understand or for your data to identify, then you can start learning stuff that ain't so.
Right. John, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks very much for talking with me.
You have been listening to Methodology Minutes. Please visit methodology.psu.edu for podcasts, software, reading lists, and more.